This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, what a week it's been for the Labour Party. Their leader, Sir Keir Starmer, has formally apologised to the whistleblowers, and Jeremy Corbyn has called the apology disappointing. And now he's facing legal action by said whistleblowers over libel claims. With all of that in mind, we'll speak to the lawyer representing the whistleblowers and one of the whistleblowers themselves. An extraordinary discovery has been made by Auschwitz Museum, hidden documents from within a six-year-old's shoes while staff were routinely cleaning out the exhibitions. Pavel Savitsky from the museum will tell us more. And comedian Ashley Blaker is back with a humorous look at life as we've come to know it. But before all of that, welcome along to this episode of the Jewish News Podcast. Let's start off, as we usually do, with a look through your copy of the Jewish News for this week. And joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and supplements editor Bridget Grant. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Now then, let's have a look at the front page. Corbyn goes to war with Starmer over High Court apology to whistleblowers. The image, well, what more can you say? You've got Sir Keir one side, Jeremy Corbyn the other. I'm sorry by Sir Keir, I'm not by Jeremy Corbyn. Need we say more? Yes, we may, Richard.
Yes, need we say more indeed. My glamorous right-hand man, Justin Cohen, tweeted the front page last night saying this is 5 years of Labour politics in one front page. Indeed, it is. The new sheriff in town, Keir Starmer, saying I'm sorry. And would you believe it? We've always known dear old Jeremy to be obdurate, unbending, unable to view current affairs or history through any other sort of prism than the one he's squinted through for the last 40 years. But even I didn't think he would be so obtuse to react to this week's Labour High Court apology to the Panorama whistleblowers by libelling them and repeating the libel. He called it disappointing. He said it was politically motivated. He has put the new sheriff in town, Keir Starmer, in a position now where he has to make a decision whether or not he removes the whip from Jeremy Corbyn. If he does, of course, there will be civil war. I would argue it's a civil war that probably needs to be fought right now in the Labour Party.
I was going to say, I think to some, actually, you say civil war. I think to some he'd be a hero, frankly. I'm just guessing that, by the way. It's not necessarily my opinion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot has changed. Let's get this straight. I mean, he said right from the start, Keir Starmer, he was, what did he call it, tearing out the poison by its roots. And he has gone a long way. The way he categorically dealt with the Long Bailey issue when she retweeted an interview that blamed Israel for the George Floyd murder, basically got rid of Rebecca Long Bailey. He has been very clear and categorical. Team Corbyn is no more. In fact, he even stood up in the Commons this week and said, you know, it's under new management. But now we are faced with a situation where Jeremy Corbyn has laid down the gauntlet to Keir Starmer and told him quite frankly, I'm not going to sit on my hands. I'm not going to apologise. Of course, we're now only a few weeks away from the EHRC report, which, if you think this has caused a stink, that one potentially could be huge. I mean, that's going literally root and branch through the last 5 years to see what was really going on under Corbyn. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But there really is now, I think, a fork in the road, if you like, between the Labour Party of old and the Labour Party as it currently is under Keir Starmer. And I wish Keir Starmer a lot of strength and a lot of patience in the weeks to come when he's dealing with the Corbynite push and the Corbynite pressure that's being applied. And I honestly thought that Corbyn at this point would have just given up and gone home.
I also think that Keir Starmer is going to have to be incredibly strong personally and with regard to his family, because a lot of the snipes from the woke left are all about the fact that he has a Jewish wife. And he is then faced with the same problem of manipulation by a Jewish lobby. So having to kind of field those two positions and keep the Labour Party together is a mighty task.
It really is, to say the least. And we're going to be discussing this a little further on in this podcast with Mark Lewis, who's the lawyer behind the whistleblowers, and also Ben Westerman, who is one of said whistleblowers. Let's have a look inside the paper. And on page 3 and page 8, you carry on the story that was on the front cover last week, which is the plight of Uyghur Muslims.
Yes, we keep sharply focused on this point. Last week, as you say, we splashed chilling echoes with the plight of the Uyghurs in northwestern China. We have done an interview this week with Rahima Mahmoud, the Uyghur representative in the UK. Her family is among thousands, hundreds of thousands, whose fate is unknown in Xinjiang province. Board of Deputies President Marie van der Zeel has written to the Chinese ambassador. You might have seen him on Andrew Marr over the weekend, making, frankly, a fool of himself by denying what was going on when he was confronted with drone footage of bound and blindfolded men being taken onto trains. The significance of that, of those images, will be lost on no one listening to this podcast. There's a lot of troubling, worrying evidence. Of course, modern-day comparisons with the Holocaust are fraught with hyperbole, inaccuracy. You know, China can be accused of many cruelties. The gas chamber is not one of them. Yet they are being ethnically and religiously persecuted. It does touch a raw nerve for the Jewish community. And the evidence does amount to a culture being eradicated. This is not an issue we are going to take our foot off of. This is an issue we're going to be pushing and pushing for weeks and months to come, until hopefully some reaction is taken and China is forced to reconsider what it's doing.
And it seems, Bridget, somewhat odd that at surface value anyway, and I could be completely wrong, so I'm prepared to be correct on this, but it seems quite odd that it's the Jewish community making more of a noise about this than, say, maybe some of the Muslim community in Britain. And I hope I'm wrong about that, but that's certainly how it would appear.
I hope so, because I think it's marvellous that certainly my editor, Richard Ferrer, that the paper has got so behind this. But the point is that I think the main thing is, why do we never hear any Muslim voices from the Arab world about anything contentious like this? I never understand. Their silence is deafening. It's quite extraordinary that they are never vocal. The Jewish community never holds back on matters like this. We're always standing up. We're always standing up for the underdog, and in a way that other people don't stand up for us. But I would like to see the Muslim community reacting to this and being as horrified.
It is telling, actually. Majid Nawaz, who's part of the panel discussion we're having on this subject, he undertook a hunger strike until 100,000 people signed a parliamentary petition. I'm pleased to say 130,000 people have now signed it. So there hopefully will be a discussion in Parliament. He called on the Muslim Council of Britain, Muslim World League, Muslim Aid to say anything, tweet anything, send a press release. There's been conspicuous silence. It's a curious one, that.
But we actually have to stand corrected here, because I have just got this in, that apparently the Muslim Council of Great Britain have approached Dominic Raab and urged him to take action. Dominic Raab, of course, is the Foreign Secretary.
Excellent. So I apologize. When was that dated?
That was from within this week. The 21st of July is when that's dated.
Okay, so a few days ago. So fine, I'll take that back. So that's the Muslim Council of Britain. Good.
Yep. I'm delighted that we were all wrong on that front. So there we go. Let's have a look, though, at a little lighter story now. Let's get ready for the weekend, shall we, Bridget? Because on page 28 and 29, that's where we find some of the weekend section of the Jewish news. And what have you got for us this weekend?
Well, there's every reason to pick up our paper or go online and see it, because, and now I know I'm accused of pushing the Woody Allen agenda, and I'm shameless about that. But one of the things that we're offering is a giveaway of his wonderful film. It's a competition, but we've also got news in the section about they're advancing the story of Dirty Dancing. Jennifer Grey, who is Joel Grey's daughter, he's just actually done a Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway, alas no more because of the situation, but they're going to be doing the new Dirty Dancing, which hundreds of people like me, who tried to be lifted by our husbands at some point, recreating that final scene, will be delighted about. Jenny Fraser, there's also a bit about Gideon Raff, you know, that wonderful director who is being hired and producing no end in Hollywood, probably, again, not at the moment. There's a bit about him. I don't want to reveal too much because I think it's good to go online and see it for yourself. But most importantly, on the front of the weekend section, we've got a piece with Deborah Barnes. Deborah Barnes is actually a girl I went to school with. She's a Henrietta Barnett girl. grew up not knowing anything about her mother's Holocaust past. It wasn't, in fact, till her mother died that I was at the funeral, and the eulogy given by Deborah's mother, Paulette's brother, was all about her childhood and their escape from France during occupation. And it's the most moving story. I mean, it's one of those ones you expect to be made into a movie, you know, anytime soon. And I highly recommend Deborah's book. She works for the AJR, Association of Jewish Refugees. And it's a special, it's been very cathartic for her as someone who grew up with her mother not talking about it. And now, I mean, I hope that Paulette's reading it in heaven somewhere.
There you go. So that's The Young Survivors by Deborah Barnes. Thank you both very much indeed. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for a look at the paper for this week. But don't forget that you can always get your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday, or alternatively, if you are isolating at the moment, you can always read the full paper online at jewishnews.co.uk. Editor Richard Ferrer, supplements editor Bridget Grant. Thank you both very much.
Cheers, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
This is the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. As we've been hearing, an extraordinary week for the Labour Party. The Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, has formally apologised to whistleblowers. Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, has called the apology disappointing. And Jeremy Corbyn is now facing legal action by the whistleblowers over libel claims. And with all of this in mind, I think we need to unpick this further. Let's start off by speaking to the lawyer who is representing the whistleblowers and has now been instructed to sue Mr. Corbyn. Mark Lewis joins me on the Jewish News podcast now. Mark, were there ever moments that you questioned the strength of this case and really your chances of actually winning anything?
No, not at all. I mean, I think what you have to understand is that both me and the barristers, including a QC, were acting on the basis of a no-win, no-fee agreement, CFA. You just don't take those on if you think that you've got a shaky case or a questionable case. You know, we were fighting on. I know what has been said by the other side, but we were confident in our case.
Let's look at how Mr. Corbyn himself has reacted to all of this, because it's not quite the way that one would expect, is it?
Well, it's an unusual response in this sense, that in every piece of litigation, one or both sides, the claimant and the defendant, can lose. It's true. I often joke that of the lawyers in court, it's usually the judge who's got the best idea, but even the judge might get it wrong and it can go to an appeal. So it's possible that the barristers for the claimant, the barristers for the defendant, might both have the view wrong. But we've taken a view that we had a good, strong case and that we would pursue it. And therefore, it's amazing that you would have people come forward and say, oh yes, we were told, we were advised that we were going to win. And moreover, they've been involved in other litigation. The Labour Party in the past, sensible people, certainly the lawyers, that they might have thought that they were going to win and they ended up losing. Any lawyer who tells you that they haven't ever lost a case that they thought they would win is lying.
Well, you have become, I think it's a fair comment to say, quite a leading figure in the fight back against the anti-Semitism surrounding the Labour Party in many different fronts, frankly. How did you come to be in this position? Because I think that we all know that you're quite a prominent lawyer in the first place, but it would appear that this is almost like what you've become associated with now.
I spend a lot of my career being typecast for certain things. I think that the answer is self-suggesting in a sense, because you follow what I do in the Jewish world. But, you know, within the last few weeks, I've won cases on behalf of soap stars against national newspapers. Bizarrely, I'm accused of being very right-wing, but I've won cases for Muslim people against the Daily Mail, substantial damages earlier this year. I've won cases arising from allegations relating to child abuse, terrorism, etc., that have led to very serious libels. I have a skill set of media law and reputation law, which is not that big a group. So people will come to me to pursue those claims. And I suppose the fact that if you do some of those cases relating to anti-Semitism or Labour Party, then other clients will come to you on that basis. I do spend a lot of my time fighting away from being known as just doing one thing.
Well, with that in mind, just finally, sorry to focus on the one thing, but what is the ultimate goal? How will you know that you've achieved everything that you've set out to achieve in this particular case?
Well, I will pursue what is in my client's interest. And if my clients instruct me to pursue cases, then I will pursue cases. That's including the cases that are coming up. There's lots of cases coming up in respect of the leaked Labour report from April to challenge that. If people are going to say things that aren't true, then the clients can instruct me to pursue and to find out the truth. And that's all I do. I find that I keep coming out with the line to people, I'm just doing my job.
Well, we thank you for doing your job, and thank you very much indeed for speaking to me on this episode of the Jewish News Podcast. That's lawyer Mark Lewis there, who represents the whistleblowers, who has now also been instructed to sue Jeremy Corbyn. Well, on that note, let us now speak to one of said whistleblowers. Now, I'm really delighted to say that Ben Westerman joins us on the Jewish News Podcast. Ben, first and foremost, there are some who describe your actions as heroic, and I wonder, how does it feel being described as a hero for such a sorry situation?
Well, of course, very flattering, but I mean, no, I don't really feel that at all. To be honest, the victory almost feels hollow, because it's just so very sad that it came to this. None of us ever wanted to do this, but we felt we had to. So, you know, as I've said in various other places, I don't think this is really about the whistleblowers per se. It's about what's happened to the Jewish community over the last 5 years. And, you know, we felt we had to do this.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because what kind of impact has this had on you personally? Because this inevitably must have taken its toll.
Of course. I mean, it's been enormously difficult for so many reasons. I mean, we think between the whistleblowers, we've got near enough a century of service to the Labour Party combined. So having to speak out against that institution to which you've given so much of your time and your life is incredibly difficult, and to have them turn on you and accuse you of lying is just awful, and it's been incredibly difficult. And, you know, it leads to all sorts of attacks on your character on social media and so on and so forth in the press, and that's just been very, very difficult. So yeah, it's been a very, very, very nasty period, and I'm glad to see it coming to a close.
In particular, what was it like pursuing the party that you have, as you already identified, given so much time too? Because I suppose in some, I don't want to trivialize it, because obviously we all know the seriousness of the situation, well, I hope we do, but the point is, it could almost be a little bit like being a part of a family and then suddenly turning on that family, but not turning your back on it, because it's not about turning your back, it's actually sort of trying to get that family to see sense, I'd imagine. But it's probably best if you say how it felt to you.
Well, that's exactly it. But rather it was the other way around, because we all worked for the party and we tried our best, but felt that the culture and the lack of leadership was such that we couldn't do anymore, and so felt the only way was to speak out. And actually, it was the Labour Party's response which felt more like a family turning on you, because having given so much to that party, for them to then put out such horrible statements about you in the media was dreadful. And so, yeah, it's been very difficult, and it's a very strange thing, because each of us joined the Labour Party as members and then as members of staff, never expecting it to come to this and for us to do what we felt we had to do.
I'm also guessing that it must have been quite counterintuitive as well, because surely there must have been at some stage part of you thinking that this kind of action that was required would lead to a sort of implosion within the Labour Party and possibly handing more power over to, say, the Conservatives, which of course is the results that we did see in the general election of late. So was there always sort of that element as well, that you were kind of tussling politically and morally?
No, I never thought about it in all honesty, because the ability to do something about this lay with the leadership of the Labour Party, and the leadership of the Labour Party could have done something about this. Indeed, even after Panorama, the leadership of the Labour Party could have taken the opportunity to apologise, to show contrition. Instead, they came out with denialism, and even now, we saw Mr Corbyn denying that this was a problem and suggesting that the party settling was a political decision, which speaks volumes to why the party fared as it did.
Would you ever work for Labour again?
I haven't, honestly, no. I haven't considered it. I haven't thought about it. I have moved on with my life. I haven't rejoined the party. I will wait to see what the EHRC report says and what action the party takes as a result of the EHRC report, and then I'll think about it. But no, I haven't considered working for the party.
Just finally, as you mentioned already, Mr Corbyn has responded to everything that is going on in quite an extraordinary manner, it has to be said. What do you personally make of his response?
I think it's very sad that after all the hurt the Labour Party over the last 5 years has caused to the Jewish community, that he, as the leader of that party during that time, even now won't take the opportunity to apologise.
Ben Westerman, thank you very much indeed. I think, frankly, on behalf of many in the community, for being brave enough to do what you did, because there's no doubt about it, it has certainly shifted the ground for the Labour Party for hopefully the right reasons. So we thank you for that. And also thank you for speaking to me on the Jewish News Podcast.
Thanks very much.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, once in a while, we stumble across really extraordinary stories, to say the least. And this one really struck me as being mind-blowing. Auschwitz Museum discovers six-year-old's shoes with hidden inscription. So what happened is that a discovery at the Auschwitz Museum has unveiled this remarkable discovery that was actually found while staff were clearing out an exhibition. I think we need to find out more about this from a man in the know. Pavel Savishki is from Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, and I am delighted to say that he joins me now on the Jewish News Podcast. Pavel, first and foremost, this is an extraordinary discovery, and it seems so hard to believe that all of these decades later, still new discoveries like this are being made.
Thank you very much for this invitation. Yes, indeed. This is a very moving and very touching story, and such things are possible even after decades after the camp was liberated. And here, the situation is that we have thousands and thousands of items, personal objects that belong to the victims of Auschwitz, and many of them are presented in our main exhibition. And if any of you ever visited the memorial, you can remember the rooms with eyeglasses or kitchenware or shoes. And this discovery was found among the shoes that are presented in the exhibition. Of course, there are many more are stored and preserved in our collections in the storage, but we do not enter into the exhibitions very often. However, once in a while, the state of preservation of each of these objects must be checked, and we are doing this gradually. And this is also a possibility of going through individual items that are presented to the visitors of the Auschwitz Memorial. We have, when we talk about the shoes altogether, we have a little bit over 110,000 shoes, including some 8,000 shoes that belong to children. So this is the checking and looking through them is something that, first of all, can be done just with, you know, little parts that we can remove from the exhibition. And then we can really search, not only, you know, look at the conservation and the state of preservation, but then such discoveries are possible. And this is what happened in this case. Two children's shoes, two different discoveries in one, some documents in Hungarian, and the second one indeed has handwritten inscription inside with a name.
And the name was Amos Steinberg, is that right?
That's right. He probably never became a prisoner. That's something that we need to remember. From the research that our collections made, we know some of the details. We know that Amos, together with his parents, with Ludwig and with Ida, they lived in Prague. They were imprisoned in the Theresienstadt ghetto near Prague. And we know that the parents and the child were deported to Auschwitz, however, in two separate transports. The father came in one, and then the mother and Amos, Ida and Amos, were deported in another transport. And from we only have here in the archives, we only have the transport list. We have their names on the transport list. And with high probability, we can say that when Ida and Amos arrived here at Birkenau, most probably because this is where the transport arrives in October of 1944, during the selection, they were murdered in a gas chamber. After the selection, they were murdered in a gas chamber. The inscription inside the shoe contains the name and the surname of a boy, but there is also a number of a transport. And this is a transport that took the family from Prague to the Theresienstadt ghetto. And most probably somewhere then, the mother decided, out of a reason we probably will never be able to understand, to sign the shoe. And the boy, the mother, did not survive. The father did. The father survived the war. We know that from Auschwitz, he was transferred to Dachau, and he was liberated in Kaufering subcamp, and later he moved to Israel. He's no longer alive. This is also what we already managed to establish and to find out. But now one of those 9,000 shoes that, of course, remind us about individual people, but it is very difficult to match a name with such a typical object as a shoe. Now this shoe is known, and we know that it belonged to Amos Steinberg.
So that's exactly what I was going to pick up on, because what's so striking about the shoe exhibitions, and we've seen them at Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum, we've also seen them obviously at Yad Vashem and other Holocaust museums and memorials, they often do display possessions of those who lost their lives during the Holocaust. And it's quite hard to really understand, fully understand, and to process that those possessions were just that. They were possessions, they belonged to an individual, they belonged to families, and it somehow makes what happened even more real and even more striking. Obviously, it's very real for the families of those who survived. But the point is that to those of us who can't necessarily firsthand understand it, looking at an object makes it more real. But of course, with so many objects, it's hard to put it on a personal level. So of course, this puts it on a real finite individual basis, and it makes it very, very striking indeed.
Well, the personal items that are presented, on one hand, of course, they talk about the scale. And it, even when you enter into the room with almost 80,000 shoes in our exhibition, which is a profound, moving experience, I always tell the visitors that they need to remember that they will not be able to understand the scale of what happened here while looking at this, because only very, very small fragment of all the items that went to this place. That we need to remember that the extermination of Jews in Auschwitz was a planned robbery, and people were encouraged to take their belongings because they were promised resettlement. And so everything we have here is just a small fragment. And if we had, for example, all the shoes that went through this place, we wouldn't have storage to place them. It would be so many. But on the other hand, when we look at those piles of different objects, we always need to remember every single one of them is one story, one name, one person. And in many cases, we cannot tell that this shoe belonged to this person and this pot to another, or a pair of eyeglasses. They represent their owners in a very symbolic way. So whenever we can discover such a personal trace, a name, a story, this is very significant, because it rehumanizes something that was the purpose of this camp. The purpose of the German Nazis who created Auschwitz was to dehumanize the victims, humiliate people who were imprisoned, and of course, when we talk about the mass murder, to erase any trace of the people who were sent straight to the gas chambers. Those people were not registered in any records of the camp. And here, somehow, on this very small scale level, this is, however you put it, this is a victory of Amos, because his name survived. And well, 75 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, we can talk about it.
Just finally, because, and speaking of making a story real, I'm speaking to you now over video link. Now, I know that this doesn't necessarily work very well on the podcast. People on the podcast can't see this, but I can. And I think that most people will be forgiven for thinking the backdrop of the famous barbed wire fence that is actually behind you is not a virtual backdrop. You actually are there. So you see this obviously every day as part of your work, and it is very real, certainly for you and for any visitors of Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum and Memorial. Just finally, though, what happens now to this discovery? Are they going to go on display? Are they going to go back into archive? Is more research? What's the plan for them?
So the shoe of Amos is right now in the collections, and probably it will stay there. We need to see if there is some conservation processing that we need to do to simply preserve the shoe. The second discovery, the documents in Hungarian, they need to go through conservation. We started the research there. There are some names that appear in the documents. However, some of them are heavily damaged, and we need time to go through this pieces of paper in the conservation labs. And then we'll be making this decision, the collections department with the exhibition department, whether the shoe will come back to this exhibition right now that doesn't have so much space for such individual stories. Unfortunately, this we are working right now with the old exhibition created by survivors in 1955. And while they wanted to show the scale of operation, there is not so many individual links. Maybe this shoe, we will be able to present it in one of our temporary exhibitions that from time to time we do. But right now, one of the most important projects that is taking place here at the Auschwitz Memorial is the change of our permanent exhibition. And this will take place in the next few years, and we will be doing this process gradually because we cannot have the situation that the memorial will be closed for visitors, and people who come here from all around the world need to have a possibility to learn the story with the exhibition. But we are going to slightly change the presentation of the individual of the items, of the personal objects. I mean, we will keep the scale. This is something, as I said, this is an experience. People come here also because they want to see the suitcases, the eyeglasses, the shoes. But the new technologies that we will be able to implement in this new exhibition will also allow us for very safe presentation of these very old items that constantly need preservation. And our plan is in this new main exhibition that we will also try to show much more items that have this individual story behind them, because simply we will be able to present them in a very safe way so that it's safe for these authentic items themselves.
Pavel Sedishki from Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, thank you very much indeed for speaking to me on the Jewish News Podcast.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I think we need a little bit of a breather now. Let's go for something a little more light-hearted, shall we? Comedian Ashley Blaker is here with his take on life as we've come to know it.
Hello, Ashley Blaker here, back on the Jewish News Podcast. And I've been thinking a lot this week about performing. As a comedian, obviously, the last few months have been a bit strange, mostly restricted to standing in front of my computer with no one there, hoping that maybe people will be laughing at the words that I say. But I've seen a lot of comedians moaning about this online, saying they hate it, that they can't wait for theatres and other venues to reopen. But I've got to be honest, I'm not sure I want to go back. I love this. I absolutely love performing without an audience. Because no offence to anyone listening to this at home at the moment, but trust me, there is nothing harder than performing for a room full of Jews. I was going to say possibly hosting the Oscars, but that is still basically performing for a room full of Jews. And I think it's simply because Jews always think they can do anything better themselves. They don't laugh. They just sit there thinking, I could have done this. What's so hard about talking into a microphone for 30 minutes? All you need is some jokes and then remember them. I don't know if Albert Einstein was much of a synagogue goer, but if he had been, I can guarantee you someone would have gone up to him and said, I could have done that. What's so hard about coming up with a theory of relativity? And of course, being Jews, I can always guarantee at least one or two in the audience will come up to me afterwards and say, yeah, there were 20 rows in the theatre, 25 seats in each row, so we reckon you've made around $6,500 tonight. Were we right? Non-Jews don't do this. A non-Jew doesn't go to see Hamilton and sit there counting the seats and thinking, you know what, Lin-Manuel Miranda's made around $100,000 tonight. I could have done this. What's so difficult about thinking of words that rhyme with burr? Now, I should say at this point that I do have a slight issue with the term non-Jews. Because I think it says a lot about the Jewish people that there's only around 250,000 of us in the country. We form less than 0.4% of the population, and yet we call everyone else non-Jews. I think that tells you everything you need to know about the Jewish psychology. No one else does this. 250,000 is roughly the number of people in the country with Alzheimer's, but they don't go around calling everyone else non-Alzheimer's. Probably because they don't remember they've got it. You don't get computer programmers calling everyone else non-binary, because that means something completely different nowadays. Anglican Christians don't call everyone else non-C of E, because that would look a bit like nonce. But anyway, I digress. Jews are a tough audience, that's what I was saying. And worst of all, Jews aren't drinkers. We just want food. So whereas a non-Jewish audience might be lubricated after some beers, my audience is either grumpy because they've not had enough to eat, or they've just had a big meal and are now nodding off. One good thing is I get to try out some new material, no one's the wiser. At one Jewish gig last year, I actually Skyped my children halfway through. No one seemed to notice. But Jews can be difficult all over the world. And actually, in Israel, they're even worse. I had years of people messaging me on social media asking when would I be coming to perform in Israel. And when I finally announced the tour, the very same people were messaging me asking when I'd be coming to their town. I said, I'm performing in Beit Shemesh. It's half an hour's drive from Moda Inn. That's the same amount of time it takes to drive from Edgware to Golders Green. But I know if I had gone to Moda Inn, they'd have gone, yeah, but when are you performing in my street? I'm doing a show in your living room. Okay, but when are you coming up to my bedroom? I can't be bothered to go downstairs. Now, just how difficult the audience is going to be may depend on how orthodox they are. Because the most religious men don't laugh. No enjoying themselves at all. Save it all up for the world to come. I was doing a show in London last year, and a friend of mine was in the audience, sat next to one of these very religious men with their long beards and a black hat, and he said he didn't laugh once the entire night. But after every single one of my jokes, he turned to his wife and said, "Ah, that was a good line. I like that line. Ah, that was a very good line." So at least he enjoyed it. Either that, or he was doing a lot of cocaine. Comedy just doesn't exist in this world. Go to a very religious synagogue on Purim, and you'll see that the bar for humour in the Orthodox world isn't really set very high. When the height of comedy is someone saying the morning prayers in a Hungarian accent, or the synagogue announcements being sent out upside down, you realise these are people who have never seen Monty Python. The only place where the Orthodox Jews are a little bit more laid back is Australia, because they're all very bawdy. You know, the men wear black hats, but they have those little corks hanging off. Honestly, Australian Jews are all like Crocodile Dundee. Go to a circumcision in Australia and the baby's looking up going, "Call that a knife." But anyway, I am going to be back performing in front of an audience at JW3 in September for 6 nights, 6 different shows of a brand new improvised comedy show. So I hope I will see you there. Until then, have a good weekend. Take care. Goodbye.
Thank you very much to comedian Ashley Blaker with some wise and humorous words for us during life as we've sort of come to know it. And there you go. That's it for this episode of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. So to find out more, you could always go to gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to all of our guests, to lawyer Mark Lewis, to whistleblower Ben Westerman, to Pavel Savishky from the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. And of course, thank you goes to our paper team, Richard Ferrer and Bridget Grant. And we must also thank Justin Cohen, who produced this episode of the Jewish News Podcast. And thank you goes to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.